blood, which had pumped out of the stalk of his head like a fountain. Kramer backed out of the car. "Shit," he said. "Did you see that? How did they... I mean, shit, it's all over the car." To which Martin had said, "Yeah, must have ruined his whole fucking day." At first, Kramer had taken this as a rebuke for his becoming unglued by the sight, but later he figured Martin wouldn't have had it any other way. What was the fun of introducing people to vintage Bronx mayhem if they didn't become unglued? After that, Kramer made a point of being as Irish as they come at the crime scenes. Martin's partner, Goldberg, was twice his size, a real side of beef, with thick curly hair, a mustache that drooped slightly at the corners of the mouth, and a fat neck. There were Irishmen named Martin and Jews named Martin. There were Germans named Kramer and Jews named Kramer, but every Goldberg in the history of the world was a Jew, with the possible exception of this one. By now, being Martin's partner, he had probably turned Irish too. Martin, in the driver's seat, turned his head slightly to talk to Kramer in the back seat. "I can't believe I'm actually driving to Harlem to listen to this asshole. If it was a wiretap, that I could believe. How the hell did he get to Weiss?" "I don't know," said Kramer. He said it wearily, just to show that he was a good knockabout fellow who realized this mission was a jerk-off. In fact, he was still sailing on the verdict that had come in last night. Herbert 92X had gone down. Shelley Thomas had popped up, glorious as the sun. Apparently Bacon called Joseph Leonard. You know Leonard, the black assemblyman? Kramer's radar told him that black was too delicate, too refined, too trendy liberal a designation for a conversation with Martin and Goldberg, but he didn't want to try out anything else.
"Yeah, I know him," said Martin. "He's a piece of work, too."
"Well, I'm only guessing," said Kramer. "But Weiss has an election coming up in November, and if Leonard wants a favor, Weiss'll do him a favor. He thinks he needs black support. This Puerto Rican, Santiago, is running against him in the primary." Goldberg snorted.
"I love the word they use, support. Like they think there's some organization out there. That's a fucking laugh. In the Bronx, they couldn't organize a cup of coffee. Bedford-Stuyvesant, the same thing. I've worked the Bronx, Bedford-Stuyvesant, and Harlem. In Harlem, they're more sophisticated. In Harlem, if you bring some asshole in and you tell him, 'Look, there's two ways we can do this, the easy way and the hard way, it's up to you,' at least they know what you're talking about. In the Bronx or Bed-Stuy, forget about it. Bed-Stuy's the worst. In Bed-Stuy, you just might as well start rolling in the dirt from the get-go. Right, Marty?"
"Yeah," said Martin, without enthusiasm. Goldberg had used no designation at all other than they. Martin didn't seem to want to get into a discussion of cop philosophy in the first place.
"So Bacon calls Leonard, and Leonard calls Weiss," said Martin. "And then what?"
"This kid Lamb, his mother works for Bacon, or she used to work for Bacon," said Kramer. "She claims she has some information about what happened to her son, but she has a whole bunch of parking tickets, and there's a scofflaw warrant out for her, and she's afraid to go to the police. So the deal is, Weiss quashes the warrant and works out a schedule whereby she can pay off the tickets, and she gives us the information, but it has to be in Bacon's presence."
"And Weiss agrees to this?"
"Yep."
"Beautiful."
"Well, you know Weiss," said Kramer. "All he cares about is he's Jewish and he's running for re-election in a county that's 70% black and Puerto Rican."
Goldberg said, "You ever run into Bacon before?"
"No."
"You better take off your watch before you go in there. Fucking guy don't lift a finger except to steal."
Martin said, "I was thinking about that, Davy. I can't see where there's any money in this thing, but you can bet it's there somewhere." Then to Kramer, "You ever hear of the Open Gates Employment Coalition?"
"Sure."
"That's one of Bacon's operations. You know how they turn up at restaurants demanding jobs for minorities? You should have been at the fucking brawl up on Gun Hill Road. There wasn't a fucking white face working up there, so I don't know what kind of minorities they're talking about unless a bunch of bongos carrying lengths of pipe. You call that a minority?"
Kramer wondered whether or not bongos could be interpreted as a racial epithet. He didn't want to be that Irish.
"Well, then, what's in it for them?"
"Money," said Martin.
If the manager said, "Oh yeah, we need some extra hands, you can all have jobs," they'd look at him like he had bugs on his eyeballs. They just take money to stay away. It's the same way with the Third World Anti-Defamation League.
They're the ones that go downtown to Broadway and raise hell.
That's one of Bacon's operations, too. He's a sweetheart.
But the Open Gates Employment Coalition, said Kramer, they actually get in fights.
Bitch fucking battles, said Goldberg.
If it's a scam, why would they do that? They could get killed.
You have to see 'em, said Martin. Those crazy fucks will go brawling all day for nothing. So why wouldn't they do it if somebody pays them a few dollars?
Remember that one that swung on you with a pipe, Marty?
Remember him? I saw him in my fucking sleep. A big, tall asshole with a gold earring hanging off his head like this.
Martin made a big O with his thumb and forefinger and put it under his right ear. Kramer didn't know how much of this to believe. He had once read an article in the Village Voice describing Bacon as a street socialist, a black political activist who had arrived at his own theories about the shackles of capitalism and the strategies required to give black people their due. Kramer had no interest in left-wing politics, and neither did his father. Yet in their house, when he was growing up, the word socialist had religious overtones. It was like zealot and Masada. There was something Jewish about it. No matter how wrong-headed a socialist might be, no matter how cruel and vindictive, he possessed somewhere in his soul a spark of the light of God, of Yahweh. Maybe Bacon's operation was extortion, and maybe it wasn't. Looked at one way, the entire history of the labor movement was extortion. What was a strike but extortion backed up by real or implied threat of violence? The labor movement had a religious aura in Kramer's house, too. The unions were a Masada uprising against the worst of the goyim. His father was a would-be capitalist, a servant of capitalists in actual fact, who had never belonged to a labor union in his life and felt infinitely superior to those who did. Yet one night, Senator Barry Goldwater had been on TV promoting a right-to-work bill, and his father had started growling and cursing in a way that would have made Joe Hill and the Wobblies look like labor mediators. Yes, the labor movement was truly religious, like Judaism itself. It was one of those things you believed in for all mankind and didn't care about for a second in your own life. It was funny about religion. His father wrapped it around himself like a cape. This guy Bacon wrapped it around himself. Herbert wrapped it around himself. Herbert. All at once, Kramer saw a way to talk about his triumph.
"It's funny about these guys in religion," he said to the two cops in the front seat. "I just got off a case, a guy called Herbert 92X. He didn't say, "I just won a case." He would work that in. "This guy..."
Martin and Goldberg probably didn't give a damn either, but at least they would comprehend. He remained an animated raconteur all the way to Harlem. Not a soul was in Reverend Bacon's great parlor office when the secretary led Kramer, Martin, and Goldberg in. Most conspicuously absent was Reverend Bacon himself. His big swivel chair rose up in suspenseful emptiness behind the desk. The secretary showed the three of them to armchairs facing the desk, and then she left. Kramer looked out the bay window behind the swivel chair at the gloomy tree trunks in the garden. The trunks were mottled in patches of swamp yellow and rotting green. Then he looked at the ceiling coving, and the plaster dental moldings, and all the other architectural details that had proclaimed millionaire 80 years ago. Martin and Goldberg were doing the same thing. Martin looked at Goldberg and twisted his lips upward on one side with a look that says, "This is a shuck." A door opened, and a tall black man entered the room looking like $10 million. He wore a black suit, tailored in a way that brought out the width of his shoulders and the trimness of his waist. The jacket had a two-button roll that revealed a gorgeous acre of white shirt front. The starched collar was immaculate against the man's dark skin. He wore a white necktie with a black crisscross pattern, the sort of necktie that Anwar Sadat used to wear.
Kramer felt rumpled just looking at him. For an instant, he debated whether or not he should rise from his chair, knowing what Martin and Goldberg would think of any gesture of respect, but he couldn't think of any way out of it, so he stood up. Martin waited a couple of moments, but then he stood up too, and Goldberg followed suit. They looked at each other, and both of them shrugged their lips this time. Since Kramer was up first, the man walked toward him and held out his hand and said,
"Reginald Bacon."
Kramer shook hands and said, "Lawrence Kramer, Bronx District Attorney's Office, Detective Martin, Detective Goldberg." From the way Martin looked at Reverend Bacon's hand with his Doberman pincher eyes, Kramer didn't know whether he was going to shake it or chew it. He finally shook it. He shook it for at least a fourth of a second, as if he had just picked up a chunk of creosote. Goldberg followed suit.
"Get you gentlemen some coffee?"
"No, thanks," said Kramer. Martin gave Reverend Bacon a frozen stare and then shook his head from side to side twice, very slowly, successfully conveying the message, "Not even if I was dying of thirst." Goldberg, the Jewish shamrock, followed suit. Reverend Bacon walked around behind the desk to his great chair, and they all sat down. He leaned back in the chair and looked at Kramer with an impassive expression for what seemed like a very long time, and then said in a soft, low voice,
"The district attorney explained to you Mrs. Lamb's situation?"
"My bureau chief did, yes."
"Your bureau chief?"
"Bernie Fitzgibbon. He's the chief of the Homicide Bureau."
"You're from the Homicide Bureau?"
"When a case is listed likely to die, they turn it over to the Homicide Bureau. Not always, but a lot of the time."
"You don't need to tell Mrs. Lamb you're from the Homicide Bureau."
"I understand," said Kramer.
"I'd appreciate that."
"Where is Mrs. Lamb?"
"She's here. She's coming in a minute. But I want to tell you something before she comes in here. She is very upset. Her son is dying, and she knows that. And she don't know that, see? It's something she knows and something she don't want to know. You understand? And all this time, here she is. She's in trouble over a lot of parking tickets. She says to herself, 'I have got to be with my son, and suppose they arrest me over a lot of parking tickets.' See?"
"Well, she don't have to worry about that," said Kramer. In a room with three people who said she don't, he couldn't get a dozen out of his mouth. "The district attorney is quashing the warrant. She's still going to have to pay the tickets, but nobody's going to arrest her."
"I told her that, but it's going to help if you tell her."
"Oh, we're here to help, but I thought she had something to tell us." This was for the benefit of Martin and Goldberg, so they wouldn't think he was being a pushover. Reverend Bacon paused again and stared at Kramer, then resumed softly as before.
"That is true. She has something to tell you. But you ought to know about her and her son Henry. Henry is... was... was... Lord, this is a tragedy. Henry is a fine young man, a fine young man. Fine as you want to meet, see? Goes to church. Never been in trouble, about to graduate from high school, getting ready to go to college. A fine young man. And he already graduated from something tougher than Harvard University. He grew up in the projects, and he made it. He survived. He came out of it a fine young man. Henry Lamb is, was, the hope, see, the hope. And now somebody just come along and, whop!" He slapped his hand down on the desktop. "Run him down and don't even stop."
Because Martin and Goldberg were there, Kramer felt the need to quench the histrionics. "That may well be, Reverend Bacon," he said, "but so far we don't have any evidence of a hit and run." Reverend Bacon gave him his level gaze and then, for the first time, smiled.
"You're going to have all the evidence you need. You're going to meet Henry Lamb's mother. I know her very well, see? And you can believe what she says. She's a member of my church. She's a hard-working woman, a good woman, see? A good woman. She's got a good job down at the municipal building and the marriage bureau. Don't take a nickel of welfare. A good woman with a good son."
Then he pressed a button on his desk and leaned forward and said,
"Miss Hadley, show Mrs. Lamb in."
Oh, one more thing. Her husband, Henry's father, was killed 6 years ago, shot to death, coming home one night outside the project, tried to resist a robber.
Reverend Bacon looked at each of the three of them, nodding the whole time. With this, Martin stood up and stared out the bay window. He stared so intently, Kramer thought he must have spotted a burglary in progress, at the very least. Reverend Bacon looked at him, puzzled.
"What kind of trees are they?"
Martin asked.
"Which one's Marty?" asked Goldberg, and he stood up, too.
"Right there,"
said Martin, pointing. Reverend Bacon swiveled around in his chair and looked out the window himself.
"Those are sycamore trees," he said.
"Sycamores," said Martin,
in the contemplative tone of a young naturalist in an arboriculture program.
"Look at those trunks. They must go up 50 feet.
"Trying to reach the light," said Reverend Bacon. "Trying to find the sun."
Behind Kramer, a pair of huge oak doors opened, and the secretary, Miss Hadley, ushered in a trim black woman, no more than 40, perhaps younger. She wore a business-like blue skirt and jacket and a white blouse. Her black hair was done in soft waves. She had a thin, almost delicate face and large eyes and the self-possessed look of a teacher or someone else used to meeting the public. Reverend Bacon stood up and walked around the desk to meet her. Kramer stood up also and understood Martin's and the Jewish Shamrock's sudden interest in the arboreal species. They didn't want to get trapped into having to stand when the woman came into the room. It had been bad enough having to get up for a hustler like Bacon. Doing it again for some woman from the projects who was part of his setup was taking this thing too far. This way, they were already on their feet studying the sycamore trees when she came in the room.
"Gentlemen," said Reverend Bacon, "this is Mrs. Annie Lamb. This is the gentleman from the district attorney's office in the Bronx, Mr. Kramer, and all."
"Detective Martin and Detective Goldberg," said Kramer. "They're in charge of the investigation of your son's case." Mrs. Lamb didn't step forward to shake hands, and she didn't smile. She nodded, ever so slightly. She seemed to be withholding judgment on the three of them. Very much the shepherd, Reverend Bacon pulled up an armchair for her. Instead of returning to his big swivel chair, he sat on the edge of the desk with an athletic casualness. Reverend Bacon said to Mrs. Lamb,
"I was talking to Mr. Kramer here, and the parking tickets, they're taken care of."
He looked at Kramer. "Well, the warrant's been quashed," said Kramer. "There's no more warrant."
"Now there's just the tickets, and as far as we're concerned, we're not interested in the tickets anyway."
Reverend Bacon looked at Mrs. Lamb and smiled and nodded his head a few times, as if to say, "Reverend Bacon delivers." She just looked at him and pursed her lips.
"Well, Mrs. Lamb," said Kramer,
"Reverend Bacon tells us you have some information for us about what happened to your son." Mrs. Lamb looked at Reverend Bacon. He nodded yes and said,
"Go ahead. Tell Mr. Kramer what you told me."
She said, "My son was hit by a car, and the car didn't stop. It was a hit and run. But he got the license number, or he got part of it." Her voice was businesslike. "Wait a minute, Mrs. Lamb," said Kramer. "If you don't mind, start at the beginning. When did you first learn about this? When did you first know your son had been injured?" "When he came home from the hospital with his wrist in this, I don't know what you call it."
"A cast?"
"No, it wasn't a cast. It was more like a splint, only it looked like a big canvas glove." "Well, anyway, he came home from the hospital with this wrist injury. When was that?"
"That was 3 nights ago.
"What did he say had happened?"
"He didn't say much. He was in a lot of pain, and he wanted to go to bed. He said something about a car, but I thought he was riding in a car, and they had had an accident. Like I say, he didn't want to talk. I think they gave him something at the hospital for the pain. He just wanted to go to bed. So I told him to go to bed."
"Did he say who he was with when it happened?"
"No, he wasn't with anybody. He was by himself."
"Then he wasn't in a car?"
"No, He was walking.
All right, go ahead. What happened next?
The next morning, he felt real bad. He tried to lift his head, and he nearly passed out. He felt so bad, I didn't go to work. I called in. I stayed home. That was when he told me a car hit him.
How did he say it happened?
He was walking across Bruckner Boulevard, and this car hit him, and he fell on his wrist, and he must have hit his head, too, because he had a terrible concussion.
At this point, her composure broke. She closed her eyes, and they were full of tears when she opened them. Kramer waited a moment. Where on Bruckner Boulevard was this?
I don't know. When he tried to talk, it was too painful for him. He'd open his eyes and shut his eyes. He couldn't even sit up.
But he was by himself, you said. What was he doing on Bruckner Boulevard?
I don't know. There's a takeout place up there at 161st Street, the Texas Fried Chicken, and Henry, he likes these things they have there, the chicken nuggets, and so maybe he was going there, but I don't know.
Where did the car hit him? Where on his body?
I don't know that either. The hospital, maybe they can tell you that.
Reverend Bacon broke in. The hospital. They fell down on the job. They didn't x-ray that young man's head. They didn't give him the CAT scan or the nuclear magnetic resonance or any of those other things. That young man comes in with a very serious injury to his head, and they treat his wrist and send him home.
Well, said Kramer, apparently they didn't know he'd been hit by a car. He turned to Martin. Is that right?
The emergency room report don't mention an automobile, said Martin.
The boy had a serious injury to his head, said Reverend Bagan. He probably didn't know half of what he was saying. They're supposed to figure out those things.
Well, let's don't get sidetracked on that, said Kramer.
He got part of the license plate, said Mrs. Lamb.
What did he tell you?
He said it started with R. That was the first letter. The second letter was E or F or P or B or some letter like that. That was what it looked like.
What state? New York?
What state? I don't know. I guess New York. He didn't say it was something else. And he told me the make.
What was it?
A Mercedes.
I see. What color?
I don't know. He didn't say.
Four-door, two-door? I don't know.
Did he say what the driver looked like?
He said there was a man and a woman in the car.
A man was driving?
I guess so. I don't know.
Any description of the man or the woman?
They were white.
He said they were white. Anything else?
No, he just said they were white.
That's all? He didn't say anything else about them or about the car?
No. He could hardly talk.
How did he get to the hospital?
I don't know. He didn't tell me.
Kramer asked Martin, did they say at the hospital?
He was a walk-in.
He couldn't have walked from Bruckner Boulevard to Lincoln Hospital with a broken wrist.
Walk-in don't mean he walked all the way there. It just means he walked in the emergency room. He wasn't carried in. The EMS didn't bring him. He didn't come in an ambulance.
Kramer's mind was already jumping ahead to trial preparation. All he could see were dead ends. He paused and then shook his head and said to no one in particular, "That don't give us very much."
"What do you mean?" said Bacon.
For the first time, there was a sharp tone in his voice.
You got the first letter on the license plate, and you got a line on the second letter, and you got the make of the car. How many Mercedeses with a license plate beginning with R-E, R-F, R-B, or R-P you think you're going to find?
There's no telling, said Kramer. Detective Martin and Detective Goldberg will run that down, but what we need is a witness. Without a witness, there's no case here yet.
No case, said Reverend Bacon. You got a case and a half, seems to me. You got a young man, an outstanding young man, at death's door. You got a car and a license plate. How much case you need?
Look, said Kramer, hoping that an ultra-patient, slightly condescending tone would take care of the implied rebuke. Let me explain something to you. Let's assume we identify the car tomorrow, okay? Let's assume the car is registered in the state of New York. And there's only one Mercedes with a license number that begins with R. Now, we've got a car, but we got no driver.
Yeah, but you can...
Just because somebody owns a car doesn't mean...
As soon as it slipped out, Kramer hoped the "doesn't" would blow by undetected. He was driving it at a particular time.
But you can question that man.
That's true, and we would. But unless he says, sure, I was involved in such and such a hit-and-run accident, we're back where we started.
Reverend Bacon shook his head.
I don't see that.
The problem is we don't have a witness. We not only don't have anybody to tell us where this thing happened, we don't even have anybody who can tell us he was hit by any car at all.
You got Henry Lamb himself.
Kramer raised his hands from his lap and shrugged gently so as not to overemphasize the fact that Mrs. Lamb's son would probably never be able to bear witness to anything again.
You got what he told his mother? He told her himself.
It gives us a lead, but it's hearsay.
It's what he told his mother.
You may accept it as the truth, and I may accept it as the truth, but it's not admissible in a court of law.
That don't make sense to me.
Well, that's the law. But in all candor, I ought to bring out something else. Apparently, when he came into the emergency room 3 nights ago, he didn't say anything about being hit by a car. That don't help matters any.
Don't. He got it right that time.
He had a concussion and a broken wrist. Probably a lot of things he didn't say.
Well, was he thinking any more clearly the next morning? You could make that argument, too.
Who's making that argument?
Said Reverend Bacon.
You're making that argument?
I'm not making any argument. I'm just trying to show you that without a witness, there's a lot of problems.
Well, you can find a car, can't you? You can interrogate the owner. You can check that car for evidence, can't you?
Sure, said Kramer. As I told you, they're going to run that down. He nodded toward Martin and Goldberg. They'll try to find witnesses, too. But I don't think a car would yield much evidence. If a car hit him, it must have grazed him. He has some bruises, but he don't have the kind of bodily injuries you'd have from being really hit by a car.
Say, if a car hit him?
This case is full of ifs, Reverend Bacon. If we find a car and an owner, and if the owner says, yeah, I hit this young man the other night, and I didn't stop, and I didn't report it, then we got a case. Otherwise, we got a lot of problems.
Uh-huh, said Reverend Bacon. So it might be you can't spend a whole lot of time on this case, being as it has so many problems.
That's not true. This case will get as much attention as any other case.
You say be candid. Well, I'm going to be candid. Henry Lamb is not a prominent citizen, and he's not the son of a prominent citizen, but he's a fine young man all the same. See, he's about to graduate from high school. He didn't drop out. He's thinking about going to college. Never been in trouble. But he's from the Edgar Allan Poe Projects. The Edgar Allan Poe Projects. He's a young black man from the Projects. Now let's turn this thing around for a minute. Suppose Henry Lamb was a young white man, and he lived on Park Avenue, and he was about to go to Yale, and he was struck down at Park Avenue by a black man and a black woman in a, Pontiac Firebird instead of a Mercedes, see? And that boy told his mother what Henry Lamb told his mother. You mean to tell me you wouldn't have a case? Instead of talking about problems, you'd be turning that information inside out and counting the stitches.
Martin came rumbling to life. We'd do the same thing we're doing right now. We've been trying to find Mrs. Lamb here for 2 days. When did we find out about a license number? You heard it. I've worked Park Avenue and I've worked Bruckner Boulevard. It don't make any difference. Martin's voice was so calm and definite, and his stare was so implacable, so mule-like, so stone-Irish, it seemed to jolt Reverend Bacon for a moment. He tried to outstare the little Irishman without success. Then he smiled slightly and said,
"You can tell me that because I'm a minister and I want to believe that justice is blind. See, I want to believe it. But you best not be going out on the streets of Harlem and the Bronx trying to tell people that. You best not be informing them about these blessings, because they already know the truth. They discover it the hard way."
"I'm on the streets of the Bronx every day," said Martin, "and I'll tell anybody who wants to know."
"Uh-huh," said Reverend Bacon. "We have an organization, All People's Solidarity. We survey the communities. And the people come to us, and I can tell you that the people are not getting your message. They are getting another message.
I've been in one of your surveys, said Martin.
You've been in what?
One of your surveys, up on Gun Hill Road.
Yeah, well, I don't know what you're talking about.
It was on the streets of the Bronx, said Martin. Anyway, said Kramer, looking at Mrs. Lamb, thank you for your information, and I hope you'll have some good news about your son. We'll check out that license number. In the meantime, if you hear about anyone who was with your son the other night or saw anything, you let us know, okay?
Uh-huh, she said, striking the same dubious note as she had at the outset.
Thank you.
Martin was still staring at Reverend Bacon with his Doberman pincher eyes, so Kramer turned to Goldberg and said,
You have a card you can give Mrs. Lamb with a telephone number?
Goldberg fished around in an inside pocket and handed her a card. She took it without looking at it. Reverend Bacon stood up.
You don't have to give me your card, he said to Goldberg. I know you, see? I'm going to call you. I'm going to be on your case. I want to see something done. All people's solidarity wants to see something done, and something will be done, see? So one thing you can count on. You will hear from me.
Anytime, said Martin. Anytime you like.
His lips were parted ever so slightly, with a suggestion of a smile at the corners. It reminded Kramer of the expression, the smirking fang, that boys wore at the beginning of a playground brawl. Kramer started walking out, saying his goodbyes over his shoulder as he went, hoping that would coax battling Martin and the Jewish Shamrock out of the room. On the drive back up to the fortress, Martin said,
Christ, now I know why they send you guys to law school, Kramer, so you can learn how to keep a straight face.
He said it good-naturedly, however.
Well, hell, Marty, said Kramer, figuring that, having been a fellow soldier with him in the bullshit skirmish at Reverend Bacon's, he could go on a nickname basis with the dauntless little Irish donkey. The kid's mother was sitting right there. Besides, maybe the license number will turn up something. You want to bet on it?
It's a possibility.
My ass, it's a possibility. You get hit by a fucking car, and you go to the hospital, and you don't happen to mention that to them? And then you go home, and you don't happen to mention it to your mother? And the next morning, you're not feeling so hot, so you say, Oh, by the way, I got hit by a car. Get out of here. That poor bastard took a beating, but it wasn't from anything he wanted to tell anybody about.
Oh, I don't doubt that. See if there's a sheet on him, will you?
You know, said Goldberg, I feel sorry for those people. They sit there saying the kid don't have a record, like that's a real fucking accomplishment. And in the projects, that's what it is. Just not having a record. That's something special. I feel sorry for it.
And a little of the Jew oozes out of the Jewish Shamrock, thought Kramer. But then Martin took up the refrain.
A woman like that, she shouldn't even be living in the project, for Christ's sake. She was all right. She was straight. Now I remember that case when her husband got killed. The guy was a working stiff who had heart. Stood up to some lowlife, and the fucking guy shot him right in the mouth. She works, don't take welfare, sends the kid to church, keeps him in school. She's all right. No telling what the kid got himself involved in, but she's all right. Half of these people, you know, something happens, and you talk to them, and they spend so much time blaming the fucking world for what happened, you can't halfway find out what the fuck happened in the first place. But this one, she was straight. Too bad she's stuck in the fucking project. But you know, he looked at Kramer when he said this, there's a lot of decent people in the projects, people that show up for work.
Goldberg nodded sagely and said,
You'd never know it now, but that's what the fucking places were built for, working people. That was the whole idea, low-cost housing for working people. And now you find somebody in there goes to work and tries to do the right thing, it breaks your fucking heart.
Then it dawned on Kramer. The cops weren't all that much different from the assistant DAs. It was the muck factor. The cops got tired of packing blacks and Latins off to jail all day, too. It was even worse for them, because they had to dive deeper into the muck to do it. The only thing that made it constructive was the idea that they were doing it for somebody, for the decent people.
So they opened their eyes, and now they were attuned to all the good people with colored skin, who rose to the top, during all this relentless stirring of the muck. You couldn't exactly call it enlightenment, thought Kramer. But it was a fucking start. Chapter 9. Some Brit Named Fallow. This time, the explosion of the telephone threw his heart into tachycardia, and each contraction forced the blood through his head with such pressure. A stroke! He was going to have a stroke lying here alone in his high-rise American hovel. A stroke! The panic roused the beast. The beast came straight to the surface and showed its snout. Fallow opened one eye and saw the telephone lying in a brown streptolon nest. He was dizzy, and he hadn't even lifted his head. Great curds of eye trash swam in front of his face. The pounding blood was breaking up the mercury yolk into curds, and the curds were coming out of his eye. The telephone exploded again. He closed his eye. The snout of the beast was right behind his eyelid. That pedophile business. And last night had started off as such an ordinary evening. Having less than $40 to get him through the next 3 days, he had done the usual. He had called up a Yank. He had called up Gil Archer, the literary agent, who was married to a woman whose name Fallow could never remember. He had suggested that they meet for dinner at Lester's, leaving the impression he would be bringing a girl along himself. Archer arrived with his wife, whereas he arrived alone. Naturally, under the circumstances, Archer, ever the bland, polite Yank, picked up the bill. Such a quiet evening, such an early evening, such a routine evening for an Englishman in New York, a dull dinner paid for by a Yank. He really was thinking about getting up and going home. And then Caroline Heftshank and this artist friend of hers, an Italian, Filippo Cirazzi, came in. And they stopped by the table and sat down, and Archer asked them if they would like something to drink. And he said why didn't they get another bottle of wine, and so Archer ordered another bottle of wine, and they drank that, and then they drank another one, and another one. And now Lester's was packed and roaring with all the usual faces, and Alex Britwithers sent over one of his waiters to offer a round of drinks on the house, which made Archer feel socially successful, recognized by the owner, sort of thing. The Yanks were very keen on that. And Caroline Heftshank kept hugging her handsome young Italian, Cirazzi, who was posing with his pretty profile up in the air, as if one were to feel privileged just to be breathing the same air as himself. St. John came over from another table to admire young Signor Cirazzi, much to Billy Cortez's displeasure, and Signor Cirazzi told St. John it was necessary for a painter to paint with the eyes of a child. And St. John said that he himself tried to view the world with the eyes of a child, to which Billy Cortez said, "He said child, St. John, not pedophile." Signor Cirazzi posed some more, with his long neck and Valentino nose rising up from out of a ridiculous electric blue punk shirt with a 3/4-inch collar and a pink glitter necktie. And so Fallow said it was more postmodern for a painter to have the eyes of a pedophile than the eyes of a child, and what did Signor Cirazzi think? Caroline, who was quite drunk, told him not to be stupid, said it quite sharply, and Fallow reared back, meaning only to strike a pose, mocking the young painter, but lost his balance and fell on the floor. Much laughter. When he got up, he was dizzy, and he held on to Caroline, just to steady himself, but young Signor Cirazzi took offense from the depths of his Italian manly honor and tried to shove Fallow, and both Fallow and Caroline now went down, and Cirazzi tried to jump on Fallow, and St. John, for whatever reason, now jumped on the pretty Italian, and Billy Cortez was screaming, and Fallow struggled up, carrying an enormous weight, and Britt Withers was over him, yelling, "For God's sake!" And then a whole bunch of people were on top of him, and they all went crashing out the front door onto the sidewalk on Lexington Avenue. The telephone exploded again, and Fallow was terrified at what he might hear if he picked up the receiver. He could remember nothing from the time they all went crashing out onto the sidewalk until this moment. He swung his feet out of the bed, and they were all still roaring and boiling inside his skull, and his whole body felt sore.
He crawled across the carpet to the exploding telephone and lay down beside it. The carpet felt dry, metallic, dusty, filthy against his cheek.
"Hello?"
"Hey, Pete, how are you?"
It was a cheery voice, a Yank voice, a New York voice, a particularly crude sort of New York voice. Fallow found this Yank voice even more jarring than the Pete. Well, at least it wasn't the City Light. Nobody at the City Light would be calling him with such a cheery voice. "Who is it?" said Fallow. His own voice was an animal in a hole.
"Jesus, Pete, you sound terrific. Any pulse? Hey, this is Al Vogel."
The news made him close his eyes again. Vogel was one of those typical Yank celebrities who, to an Englishman reading about them in London, seemed so colorful, irrepressible, and morally admirable. In person, in New York, they always turned out the same way. They were Yanks, which is to say, crude bores. Vogel was well known in England as an American lawyer whose specialty was unpopular political causes. He defended radicals and pacifists, much the way Charles Gary, William Kunstler, and Mark Lane had. Unpopular, of course, merely meant unpopular with ordinary people. Vogel's defendants were certainly popular enough with the press and intellectuals in the 1960s and 1970s, especially in Europe, where anyone defended by Albert Vogel grew wings, a halo, a toga, and a torch. Few of these latter-day saints had any money, however, and Fallow often wondered how Vogel made a living, especially since the 1980s had not been kind to him. In the 1980s, not even the press and intellectuals had any patience for the sort of irascible, seething, foul-humored, misery-loving, popped-vein clientele he specialized in. Lately, Fallow had been running into the great defender at the most extraordinary parties. Vogel would go to the opening of a parking lot, and Fallow would say hello to him there.
"Oh, hi," said Fallow,
in what ended up as a moan.
"I called your office first, Pete, and they said they hadn't seen you."
Not good, thought Fallow. He wondered when, if, why, where he had given Vogel his home telephone number.
"You still there, Pete?"
Fallow had his eyes closed. He had no sense of up or down.
"It's all right. I'm working at home today."
"I've got something I want to talk to you about, Pete. I think there's a hell of a story in it."
Yeah, only I'd just as soon not go into it over the telephone. I tell you what, why don't you come have lunch with me? I'll meet you at the Regent's Park at 1 o'clock.
I don't know, Al. The Regent's Park, where is that?"
"On Central Park South, near the New York Athletic Club."
Fallow was torn between two profound instincts. On the one hand, the thought of getting off the floor, of shifting the mercury yoke for a second time for no other reason than to listen to an American bore and has-been for an hour or two. On the other hand, a free meal at a restaurant. The pterodactyl and the brontosaurus were locked in mortal combat on the cliff over the lost continent. The free meal won, as it had so often in the past.
"All right, Al. I'll see you at 1 o'clock. Where is this place again?"
"On Central Park South, Pete, right near the New York AC. It's a nice place. You can look at the park. You can look at a statue of Jose Marti on a horse."
Fallow said goodbye and struggled to his feet, and the yoke was yawing this way and that way, and he stubbed his toe on the metal frame of the bed. The pain was terrific, but it focused his central nervous system. He took a shower in the dark. The plastic shower curtain was suffocating. When he closed his eyes, he had the feeling he was keeling over. From time to time, he had to hold on to the shower head. The Regent's Park was the sort of New York restaurant favored by married men having affairs with young women. It was grand, glossy, and solemn, with a great deal of marble inside and out, a colossal stiff neck whose hauteur appealed mainly to people staying at the nearby Ritz-Carlton, Park Lane, St. Moritz, and Plaza hotels.
In the history of New York, no conversation had ever begun with, "I was having lunch at the Regent's Park the other day," and... True to his word, Albert Vogel had secured a table beside the great window. This was not a hard ticket at the Regent's Park. Nevertheless, there it was, the park, in its springtime glory. And there was the statue of José Martí, which Vogel had also promised. Martí's horse was rearing up, and the great Cuban revolutionary was leaning perilously to the right in his saddle. Fallow averted his eyes. An unsteady park statue was too much to contend with. Vogel was in his usual hearty mood. Fallow watched his lips move without hearing a word. The blood drained from Fallow's face and then his chest and arms. His hide turned cold. Then a million little scalding hot minnows tried to escape from his arteries and reach the surface. Perspiration broke out on his forehead. He wondered if he was dying. This was the way heart attacks began. He had read that. He wondered if Vogel knew about coronary resuscitation. Vogel looked like someone's grandmother. His hair was white, not gray white, but a silky, pure white. He was short and pudgy. In his palmy days, he had been pudgy, too, but he had looked scrappy, as the Yanks like to say. Now his skin was pinkish and delicate. His hands were tiny and had ropey old veins leading up to the knuckles. A cheery old woman.
"Pete," said Vogel, "what do you have to drink?"
"Not a thing," said Fallow, rather over-emphatically. Then to the waiter, "Could I have some water?"
"I want a margarita on the rocks," said Vogel. "Sure you won't change your mind, Pete?"
Fallow shook his head. That was a mistake. A poisonous hammering began inside his skull.
"Just one to turn the motor over?"
"No, no."
Vogel put his elbows on the table and leaned forward and began scanning the room, and then his eyes fastened on a table slightly behind him. At the table were a man in a gray business suit and a girl in her late teens, with long, straight, very showy blonde hair.
"You see that girl?" said Vogel.
"I could swear that girl was on his committee, whatever they call it, at the University of Michigan."
"What committee?"
"This student group. They run the lecture program. I gave a lecture at the University of Michigan 2 nights ago."
"So what?"
thought Fallow. Vogel looked over his shoulder again.
"No, it's not her. But Christ, it sure looks like her. These goddamn girls at these colleges, you want to know why people go out on the lecture circuit in this country?"
"No," thought Fallow.
"Okay, for the money, but not counting that. You want to know why?"
The Yanks constantly repeated introductory questions.
"These goddamn girls!"
Vogel shook his head and stared off distractedly for a moment as if stunned by the very thought.
"I swear to God, Pete, you have to hold yourself back. Otherwise, you'd feel so fucking guilty. These girls today?"
"Well, when I was growing up, the big deal was that when you went to college, you could drink when you felt like it, okay? These girls, they go to college so they can get laid when they feel like it. And who do they want? This is the part that's really pathetic. Do they want nice-looking, healthy boys their own age? No. You want to know who? They want authority, power, fame, prestige. They want to get laid by the teachers. The teachers go crazy at these places now. You know, when a movement was going strong, one of the things we tried to do on the campuses was to break down that wall of formality between the faculty and the students because it was nothing but an instrument of control. But now, Jesus Christ, I wonder. I guess they all want to get laid by the fathers, if you believe Freud, which I don't. You know, this is one thing the women's movement has made no headway with. When a woman reaches 40, her problems are just as big now as they ever were, and a guy like me has never had it so good. I'm not so old, but for Christ's sake, I've got gray hair."
White, thought Fallow, like an old woman's.
"And it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. A little touch of celebrity and they fall over. They just fall over. I'm not bragging, because it's so pathetic, and these goddamn girls, each one is more of a knockout than the last one. I'd like to give them a lecture on that subject, but they probably wouldn't know what I was talking about. They have no frame of reference about anything. The lecture I gave the night before last was on student commitment in the 1980s.
I was dying to know, said Fallow in the back of his throat without moving his lips.
Pardon?
The Yank said pardon instead of what?
Nothing.
I told them what it was like on the campuses 15 years ago. His face clouded over. But I don't know, 15 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, they have no frame of reference. It's all so remote to them. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 5 years ago, was before Walkman earphones. They can't imagine that.
Fallow stopped listening. There was no way Fogle could be deflected from his course. He was irony-proof. Fallow glanced at the girl with the long yellow hair.
Thrashing through the restaurant, Caroline Heftshank and the frightened look on her face. Had he done something just before they all went crashing out the door? Whatever. She deserved it. But what was it?
Vogel's lips were moving. He was going through his entire lecture.
Fallow's eyelids dropped shut. The beast broke the surface and thrashed about and eyed him. He eyed him straight down his filthy snout. Now the beast had him. He couldn't move.
Managua? Asked Vogel.
What?
You ever been there?
Asked Vogel. Fallow shook his head. The yawing motion made him nauseous.
You ought to go. Every journalist ought to go. It's about the size of, oh, I don't know, East Hampton? If it's that big. Would you like to go there? It would be easy enough to set it up for you.
Fallow didn't want to shake his head again.
Is that the story you wanted to tell me about?
Vogel paused a moment, as if weighing the remark for sarcastic content.
No, he said, but it's not a bad idea. About 1/50th of everything that ought to be said about Nicaragua gets printed in this country. No, what I was talking about is something that happened in the Bronx 4 days ago. It might as well be Nicaragua if you happen to live there. Anyway, you know who Reverend Bacon is, don't you?
Yes, I think so.
He's a... Well, he's a... You've read about him or seen him on TV, haven't you?
Yes.
Vogel laughed.
You want to know where I first met him? In this gigantic duplex apartment on Park Avenue, Peggy Freiskamp's apartment, back when she was interested in the Geronimo Brotherhood. She gave a fundraising party there. This must have been the late 60s, early 70s. There was this guy, Flying Deer. He gave the soul talk, we used to call it. There was always the soul talk and the money talk. Anyway, he gave the soul talk, the spiritual talk. She didn't know the son of a bitch was loaded. She just thought it was Indian talk, the crazy way he sounded. 15 minutes later, he threw up all over this $80,000 Duncan Fife piano Peggy had, all over the keys and the strings and the hammers and everything. You know those little felt hammers? Oh, it was outrageous. She never got over it. That jerk blew a good deal that night. And you want to know who really gave him hell? Reverend Bacon. Yeah, he was getting ready to ask Peggy to support some of the things he had going, and when this Flying Deer threw his cookies all over the Duncan Fife, he knew he could say goodbye to Peggy Freiskamp. He started calling him Flying Beer.
Flying Deer? Flying Beer, if I know anything about it. Jesus, it was funny.
But he wasn't trying to be funny. Bacon never tries to be funny. Anyway, he has this woman who works for him sometimes, Annie Lamb from the Bronx. Annie Lamb lives in the Edgar Allan Poe project with this one son she has, Henry.
She's black? Asked Fallow.
Yeah, she's black. Practically everybody in the Poe projects is black or Puerto Rican. By law, incidentally, all these projects are supposed to be integrated.
Vogel shrugged his eyebrows.
Anyway, this Annie Lamb is an unusual woman.
Vogel recounted the history of Annie Lamb and her family, culminating in the hit-and-run Mercedes-Benz that had left her promising son, Henry, at death's door. Unfortunate, thought Fallow, but where's the story? As if anticipating that objection, Vogel said,
Now there's two sides to this thing, and both of them have to do with what happens to a good kid like this if he has the misfortune of being black and growing up in the Bronx. I mean, here's a kid who did everything right. You talk about Henry Lamb, you're talking about the 1% who do exactly what the system tells them they're supposed to do, okay? So what happens? First, the hospital treats the kid for a broken wrist.
If this had been a middle-class white kid, they'd have gone over him with the X-ray, the CAT scan, the nuclear magnetic resonance, everything there is. Second, the police and the DA won't move on a case. This is what really infuriates the kid's mother. Here's a hit and run. They've got part of the license number and the make of the car, and they're doing zip about it.
Why?
Well, basically, it's just some kid in the South Bronx who gets hit by a car, as far as they're concerned. They can't be bothered. But what they're saying is there were no witnesses, except for the victim himself, and he's in a terminal coma, and so they wouldn't have a case, even if they found the car and the driver. Now, suppose this were your son. He's provided the information, but they're not going to use it because technically it's hearsay. The whole thing made Fallow's head hurt. He couldn't imagine having a son, and certainly not in some council flats in the Bronx section of New York City in America.
"It's an unfortunate situation," said Fallow, "but I'm not altogether sure there's a story in it."
"Well, there's going to be a story in it very shortly for somebody, Pete," said Vogel. "The community is up in arms. They're about to explode. Reverend Bacon is organizing a protest demonstration."
"What exactly are they exploding over?"
"They're tired of being treated as if human life in the South Bronx means nothing, and I'm telling you, when Bacon gets hold of something, things happen. He's not Martin Luther King or Bishop Tutu, okay? He's not going to win any Nobel Prize. He's got his own way of doing things, and sometimes it might not stand close scrutiny, but that's one reason he's effective. He's what Hobsbawm called a primitive revolutionary. Hobsbawm was a Brit, right?"
"He still is."
"I thought he was. He had this theory about primitive revolutionaries. There are certain natural leaders of the underclasses, and the power structure interprets what they do as crime. They may even sincerely interpret it that way. But what that person is a revolutionary. And that's what Bacon is. I admire him, and I feel sorry for these people. Anyway, I think there's a hell of a story here, quite aside from the philosophical considerations." Fallow closed his eyes. He saw the snout of the beast, lit up by soft bistro lights. Then the icy chill. He opened his eyes. Vogel was staring at him with his cheery old pink nanny's grin. This ridiculous country. "Look, Pete, the worst you'll get out of this is a good human interest story, and if things break right, you'll be onto something big. I can get you an interview with Annie Lamb, I can get you an interview with Reverend Bacon, I can take you right into the intensive care unit where the kid is. I mean, he's in a coma, but you can see him." Fallow tried to conceive of transferring the mercury egg and his bilious innards to the Bronx. He could scarcely imagine surviving the trip. From his viewpoint, the Bronx was like the Arctic. It was somewhere to the north, and people didn't go there.
"I don't know, Al. My specialty is supposed to be the high life."
He attempted a smile.
"Supposed to be, Peter. Supposed to be. They won't fire you if you come in with a hell of a good story from the low life."
The word fire was what did it. He closed his eyes. The snout was not there. Instead, he saw the dead mouse's face. He could see the mouse looking toward his cubicle in the city room at this moment and finding it empty. Fear suffused his every cell, and he put his napkin to his forehead.
"Do you mind if I ask you something, Al?"
"Go ahead."
"What's your interest in all this?"
"None, if you're talking about material interest. Reverend Bacon called me and asked my advice, and I told him I'd try to help him out, that's all. I like him. I like what he's trying to do. I like the way he shakes up this fucking city. I'm on his side. I told him he should try to get this thing into the newspapers before he has the protest demonstration. That way he's going to get more television coverage and everything else. I'm telling you the plain truth now. I thought of you because I figured maybe you could use an opportunity like this. This could be to your advantage and to the advantage of a lot of decent people who never get a fucking break in this city."
Fallow shuddered. Just what had Vogel heard about his situation? He didn't really want to know. He knew he was being used. At the same time, here was a piece of meat to throw to the mouse.
"Well, maybe you're right."
"I know I'm right, Pete. This is going to be a big story, one way or the other. You might as well be the one to break it."
"You can take me to see these people?"
"Oh, sure. Don't worry about that. The only thing is you can't sit on the story. Bacon is ready to go."
Let me take down some of these names.
Fallow reached into the side pocket of his jacket. Christ, he hadn't even picked up a notebook or a piece of paper before he left.
From out of the pocket he brought a notice from Con Edison warning him that his gas and electricity were about to be cut off. He couldn't even write on it. It had print on both sides.
Vogel watched all this and, without comment, produced a memorandum pad and handed it to him. Then he handed